Human beings have always had some interest in predicting the future, or at least in speculating about the future. One of our longest standing American periodicals, the Farmer's Almanac, which in addition to poems, recipes, and fishing recommendations, also offers an annual prediction of the coming year's weather. And according to this year's almanac, we're scheduled for a mild winter, but be warned, we may see some early November snow. We'll see. The weather modeling technique used by the editors of the almanac are not shared with the public, but this tradition of weather predicting seems to borrow as much from folk wisdom as it might from modern science. It's a lasting artifact from a period that predated the advent of modern climate science. The almanac may not be our most accurate source of future weather possibilities, but the almanac still taps into a continued cultural desire to predict the future. The future is unknown, and the unknown can generate anxiety and fear. And predicting future outcomes has become an increasingly important exercise in a rapidly changing world, a world where our environment, our political system, and our global economy are all going through significant changes, changes that pose increasing threats to the well-being and potentially to the existence of humanity. This type of predictive science that looks out into the future to evaluate the potential for forthcoming risks is sometimes called consequence analysis. Given a certain global challenge, what are the world of possible outcomes that humanity and the Earth may be confronted with in the future? Consequence analysis is also sometimes just called what-if analysis. Climate scientists might use this type of analysis to ask, what if sea levels were to rise by 9 inches, or 21 inches, or 36 inches? What would happen to the coastal and low-lying communities of Massachusetts? How might rising sea levels displace people from their homes, disrupt public transportation, or affect local businesses? What-if analysis has also entered our popular imaginations and crept into our literature and our films. Post-apocalyptic stories still seem to be having their moments, and some of them consider alternate histories, like what if Germany had won World War II? Or what if the southern states had won the Civil War? We have books and television shows that explore and model dystopian future worlds where Nazis occupied the eastern portion of the United States, or where Robert E. Lee was our 16th president and not Abraham Lincoln. Exploring these alternate histories and their resulting dark futures seem to offer a reminder of the utter importance of making social and political decisions that broadly benefit the common good. It's an important exercise for any society to imagine how the future might unfold, to wonder how our cultural practices and habits, our beliefs and our convictions might affect the people of our own communities, of our nation, and of the whole world. In our reading this morning from the Gospel of Luke, we encounter a historic religious group of observant Jewish people called Sadducees. The Sadducees were a bit quirky. They were the religious pragmatists of their day. They followed the laws of Moses, but they were not especially partial to the supernatural elements of religious belief. Unlike the Pharisees and the Essenes who wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Sadducees rejected the idea of the bodily resurrection in the afterlife. In this text, the Sadducees are performing their own consequence analysis on the afterlife. They're playing a game of what if with Jesus. They're considering an alternate history to test how Jesus' miraculous beliefs might account for the pragmatic nuances of traditional religion in the future. In the Sadducees' what if scenario, there are 7 brothers and 1 dear, but thankfully fictional, woman who, following the cultural practices of that time, marries each of the 7 brothers in turn, and in each instance, she's widowed without having any children. The quagmire being, if the bodily resurrection of the dead is true, who of these 7 brothers will this woman be married to in heaven? The Sadducees seem to be poking a bit of fun. It's kind of an absurd type of scenario, but their point is well taken. Some elements of Jesus' teachings will pose future pragmatic problems for the observance of traditional religion. The interesting thing about Jesus' response is that he doesn't address the particulars of the scenario. Instead, he seems to challenge the very spirit of the scenario, the idea that somehow this woman's experience of the afterlife, let alone her value and worth here on earth, was tied up in marrying these seven brothers. Jesus liberates the conversation from the confines of tradition and tells the men that if the woman were to be resurrected and to end up in heaven, it would not be due to the fact that she had been someone's wife seven times, but rather because she herself was a member of God's family, a child with all the rights and privileges of being a daughter in this life and in the next. Jesus doesn't end there. He then brings the Sadducees back several thousand years and reminds them of Moses' well-known encounter with the burning bush. God appears to Moses in flames and charges Moses with leading the Israelites out of captivity and slavery in Egypt. Moses responds apprehensively to this request and asks God, "If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is this God's name?' what shall I tell them?" God tells Moses, "Tell them that I am who I am." Modern Hebrew Bible scholars have challenged this anglicized translation of the text and have suggested an alternate translation. It's a little bit less definitive, that is closer to, "I am becoming who I am becoming." A God who is becoming is not static and doesn't seem to be satisfied with the status quo. This God, the God who led Moses and the Israelites to freedom, the God of the Sadducees and of Jesus, was not satisfied with slavery or with a personal identity that was only defined by one marriage or by seven. This seems to be the implication of the resurrection. Freedom from captivity and oppression, from literal chains of slavery and from cultural chains that hold each of us back from becoming who God has called us to be. This account in Luke seems to provide a certain context within we might consider some of the dynamics of life. We all have our own family histories and cultures of origin, our own Abrahams and Isaacs and Jacobs, our own matriarchs and patriarchs, those who came before us. We also have our own predictions about the future, our own what-if scenarios, about the unfolding circumstances of our lives, our hopes and fears about the future and what it might bring. Regardless of our religious tradition, we all have beliefs. We seldom discuss them publicly, but there are ideas and convictions that each of us hold to be true and self-evident that inform the ways in which we navigate life. Our personal beliefs express something about our own human experiences, our personhood. They inform our own process of becoming. This morning, we gather here at St. John's to baptize Ella Ray Betsy Brewer, into the community of her family and her friends. Baptism, at least in part, strives to honor these same parts of Ella Ray's own inherited family tradition. She'll even be baptized with the Civil War era cup of her paternal great, 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 great grandfather, John Reed, who was a prisoner of war, a man who experienced both captivity and freedom. We also will honor Ella Ray's person, her unique place in this world. She too is going to become who she becomes. So as we honor the past and look forward to the future, we're going to welcome Ella Ray into the community of all faithful people through baptism. We are going to pray prayers of hope that Ella Ray always remembers that God is with her, that Jesus' most important commandment is that we might love one another as we've been loved. We'll pray that she becomes a person of peace and unity, a person who respects the dignity of every other human being, a person who one day will make the world a better place. In the modern world, when we consider the consequences and possible outcomes of the most pressing issues of our day, when we consider what our world might look like in the future, a world shaped by environmental degradation and partisan politics, economic inequality, that future might seem to be grim. The good news is that human beings are not static creatures. We are becoming. And we too can be formed into a fuller image of God's love. When we do imagine the future, let's not be cynical. Let's be brave in the face of difficulty. Let us take heart and be encouraged in the work that God has called each of us to do, the work of making the world a more equitable and peaceful place. Let's hope that our future selves and our families, our future communities and our future world will be marked by the love of God, and that we'll find experiences of freedom and peace in this life and in the next. Amen.